Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, Professor Lloyd Meyer from the Administrative Law Practice Group is discussing the tax-exempt status of universities with endowments. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, let's hand it over to Professor Meyer.
Welcome to this overview of the debate over whether schools that have endowments should have to spend more to remain tax exempt. My name is Lloyd Meyer. I'm an associate professor at Notre Dame Law School, where I specialize in tax and not-for-profit organization issues. Before joining the Notre Dame faculty, I represented not-for-profit organizations as part of the Washington, D.C. law firm of Kaplan and Drysdale, and I am also still of counsel with that firm. The current debate over endowment spending by colleges and universities began with a 2007 letter from Senator Max Baucus, Finance Committee Chairman, and Senator Chuck Grassley, ranking member of the same committee. That letter to then Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson contained a laundry list of concerns relating to charities. The second item on that list was why charities holding endowments, primarily tax-exempt colleges and universities, were not required by law to spend any set amount. Now, this issue is not a new one. More than 30 years ago, the Blue Ribbon Commission on Private Philanthropy and Public Needs, more commonly known as the Filer Commission, made a similar suggestion. Senators Baucus and Grassley have, however, reignited this debate, not only through the 2007 letter, but by continuing to focus on this issue since then. Their efforts have led to a Congressional Research Service report on school endowments, letters from the senators to the schools with the largest endowments asking for detailed information, a Capitol Hill roundtable of school officials and others later in 2008 to discuss endowments, and increased IRS scrutiny of college and university endowments. These events and activities have led to broader calls for schools to spend more generously. In response, a number of major universities, including Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, have announced sharply increased financial aid budgets. So while Congress has not yet enacted any new rules, this increased attention has already had an effect. Now, endowments have also been in the news recently for another reason. The current economic troubles have had a significant negative effect on endowment values. Press reports indicate that many schools have seen their endowments drop by 25% or more since June 2008, with an equal impact on income from those endowments. In response, schools that are the most dependent on such income have had to cut budgets, freeze hiring, and halt construction projects. At the same time, Senator Grassley has warned of unspecified congressional action if such schools seek to raise tuitions instead of tapping their depleted endowments to maintain current operations. This congressional attention and the drop in endowment values brings into focus the two key questions relating to endowments. First, how much should schools spend now as opposed to later? And second, and as importantly, who should make this decision, the schools themselves or the government? Well, simply stated, neither question is easy to answer. But before we explore attempts to answer these questions, we need to first understand the scope of the issue. Overall, colleges and universities rely on investment income for approximately 19% of their revenues. This figure is from the 2005 IRS filings of such schools, as compiled in the Nonprofit Almanac for 2008. But this single figure masks a wide variation among schools. At one end of the scale, you have Harvard University, with an endowment of over $36 billion as of June 2008. But the numbers drop quickly from there. Yale's endowment is the second largest, but with only two-thirds the size of Harvard's at about $23 billion, while the 20th largest school endowment of approximately $5 billion was the University of Virginia's. Yes, public colleges and universities can also have endowments, although they usually keep such endowments in affiliated private organizations. The endowment size also varies compared to the size of the institution involved. The Congressional Research Service report I mentioned earlier notes that per undergraduate student, endowments raise in size from $2.8 million at Yale to $33,000 for the University of California system, an enormous variation. In fact, of the several thousand private and public colleges and universities in the United States, only approximately 140 had endowments of more than $500 million. This is from the definitive annual report on endowments that's issued by the National Association of College and University Business Officers. Well, that is a lot of money in an absolute sense. College university annual budgets can exceed $1 billion, and even relatively small liberal arts colleges usually have budgets in the tens of millions. For this reason, income from endowments is only significant for a relatively small proportion of schools. For example, that Congressional Research Service report notes that 25% of endowment value is concentrated at the top five institutions, which only make up less than 1% of all institutions of higher education. But for those institutions for which endowments is a major funding source, it can cover a tenth, a fifth, or even a third of annual operating expenses. There are also significant differences between endowments that may be of the same dollar size or the same proportion compared to the operating budget of the school. For example, Harvard University has reported that approximately 80% of its endowment is so-called true endowment. That is, Harvard promised donors who provided those funds that those funds would be maintained in perpetuity over some other period of time. So Harvard legally can only spend as much as these donors allow from those funds. In contrast, other schools may have much fewer donor restrictions. For example, the University of Notre Dame has a $6 billion endowment, but only half of that is true endowment. The other half is what is known as quasi-endowment, funds set aside not by donors, but by the university's trustees. And of course, what the trustees have done, they can always undo. The bottom line is that for many colleges and universities, endowments are relatively small contributors to their annual operating budgets. But for many of the most prestigious schools, public and private, endowments represent a major source of funds for the operating expenses, even at the payout rates that have been the subject of congressional criticism. These differences among endowments are relevant to both the question of whether schools should spend more now, as opposed to later, and the question of who should decide, the schools themselves or the government. So what are the reasons for establishing and seeking to grow endowments? In a 1990 article, Yale professor Henry Hansman tried to answer this question. What he found is that while a lot of plausible reasons could be asserted, it is very difficult to determine whether any of the reasons could withstand careful scrutiny. Oversimplifying a bit, there are three main reasons for establishing endowments. First, endowments provide a stable source of financing for future expenses, including many long-term financial commitments. Second, endowments promote intergenerational equity, for providing funding for the education of future generations. Third, and perhaps less nobly, endowments secure and enhance the positions of faculty, administrators, and trustees. Turning to the first reason, which is probably the most commonly cited for establishing and growing an endowment. It's incredibly important for higher education institutions to have stable funding. They make many long-term financial commitments, which then they're on the hook for decades. For example, when a faculty member is granted tenure, the university has agreed to employ that professor until they choose to retire. Similarly, college and universities have extensive physical plants that require upkeep and maintenance for many decades. Schools also have fewer options than businesses to generate revenue. They can't issue stock, so they can't access the equity markets. They also generally are perceived as having less access to the credit markets. Now, the financial stability reason for having endowments has two flaws, however. The first problem is that attempts to quantify the long-term financial commitments of a school, such as maintaining faculty salaries, facilities costs, and important programs, fail to demonstrate that the levels of endowments at the top end of the scale can be justified. This is particularly true given it's the most prestigious schools that tend to have the largest endowments. And these are also the same schools that are least likely to suffer from a significant drop in demand from potential students or even in private donations and government grants. While certainly some endowment level may be justified to smooth out revenue streams that otherwise would vary over time depending on economic conditions, the current level of the largest endowments seems to go well beyond what can be demonstrated as needed for such smoothing out. The second problem with the financial stability reason is that endowments are particularly vulnerable to stock market and other investment downturns. In fact, today, many of the schools that are taking the most draconian steps with respect to across-the-board budget cuts, hiring and salary freezes, and halting construction projects are the same schools with the largest endowments, such as Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. Schools that have relatively small endowments, and so did not depend on those endowments for much of their revenues, are finding it to be much easier in the current economic environment. as demand for education has remained the same or even strengthened. Now, the problems at some large endowment schools might be attributable not solely to reliance on endowment income, but perhaps over-reliance or overspending from those endowments that in the long run realistically could not have been sustained. But the fact remains that those schools have essentially failed to demonstrate that the reason for their endowments was to provide financial stability, given that those endowments have failed to do so. Another reason for having and maintaining endowments is to ensure that the schools of today will be able to serve future generations of students as ably as they serve the current generation. The argument is essentially that endowments are a way of saving money today to fund the education of the future. This is particularly important, it is argued, because the education of the future will both be more costly and also probably the education levels expected will be higher at that point. So the only way to keep that higher education in the future available to those future generations is to save some money now. Again, there are several problems with this reason. First, the economy is, current events notwithstanding, generally expected to grow in the long term. A growing economy will provide future generations with greater wealth, with which they can use to purchase future education, whether through tuition payments or through future contributions to schools. It's therefore not clear whether the current generation should be sacrificing to save to pay for the future generation's education, or whether it should be the other way around. Maybe the future generation, in fact, will be wealthier than the current generation today, even taking into account increased costs, increased demands for higher education levels. Another problem with intergenerational equity as a reason for endowments is it assumes that financial investments are the best way to provide that equity. But it could easily be argued that a better investment would be for a school to put its money into facilities and faculty now, rather than securities and real estate. Or even a better investment might be to invest more in students and their current education so that tomorrow those students will be able to generate the resources needed for tomorrow's students. A final reason for having endowments is to secure and enhance the status of a school and effectively its insiders, its faculty, its administrators, and trustees. Now, this reputational enhancement is not necessarily purely self-serving. Certainly, past and current students appreciate an enhanced reputation and the perceived benefits it brings in the larger economy and society. But there's a dark side to this reputation security and enhancing reason. Current faculty, administrators, and trustees may have an incentive to overinvest in endowments so as to secure their own positions and enhance their current reputations, even if it might be better for students and for society as a whole to spend more now as opposed to later. The bottom line is, therefore, that it's far from clear that the current level of endowments and of spending from those endowments can be justified, at least with respect to the largest endowments. The question that remains, however, is who should evaluate these various reasons and determine whether schools should increase their endowment spending. An initial reaction to this question might be that it is up to a school's various stakeholders to discuss and argue their way to a decision that they believe is appropriate for their school. Levers that these stakeholders can use include donors saying whether their gifts should go into the endowment or should be spent now, students, parents, and faculty lobbying for increased spending now or, less likely, decreased spending in favor of spending in the future, alums asserting their interests in the value of the school and its future, and, of course, university administrators and trustees taking all of these various constituencies into account in making their decisions. There is another option, though. The government, either state governments or the federal government, could set the rules instead. Turning to the state governments first, an argument for state government involvement is the fact that the states already set the general rules for investing in endowments. But a closer examination of that rule reveals that the states have for decades been moving away from regulating endowments as opposed to increasing their role with respect to them. Originally, schools had to invest endowments very conservatively, or risk violating their fiduciary duties under state law. Starting several decades ago, however, most states changed their laws to permit schools to instead follow modern portfolio theory with respect to diversification and balancing of risk versus return. This change was driven by the promulgation of the Uniform Management of Institutional Funds Act, or UMIFA, which incorporated modern portfolio theory. More recently, many states have replaced UMIFA with the recently created Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, or UPMIFA. UPMFA further loosens the state law restrictions on endowments by relieving schools and others who manage charitable assets from an absolute requirement that they not spend below the dollar amount of the original gift without donor permission. That restriction has proven to be particularly problematic during current economic times. As this trend indicates, state governments have increasingly left management of endowment funds to schools and others holding such funds. The only significant exception has been policing compliance with donor wishes with respect to use of funds. And schools are, of course, always free to reject gifts that come with an unacceptable donor restriction. Once they accept such a gift, they, of course, have to follow that restriction, and states have a role to play when that occurs. It has therefore been left to members of Congress, though, to try to regulate spending from endowments more generally, beyond simply regulating compliance with donor intent and overall investment responsibilities. The hooks invoked by Senators Baucus and Grassley for such a federal role are the obvious ones. Colleges and universities enjoy exemption from federal income tax, which extends to their endowment income, and donors to endowments receive tax deductions. The federal government, therefore, has the ability to place conditions on these tax benefits, including with respect to endowment spending. But while it has the ability, the question remains whether it should exercise that ability. There are two reasons to support a federal government role. One reason arises from the fact that the existing income tax exemption already creates an incentive for schools to spend more later rather than sooner. So it can be argued that for the sake of creating a counterbalance, some sort of other rule is needed to support current spending. A second reason arises from the fact that an endowment spending rule that the government imposed on private grant-making foundations 40 years ago appears to have both increased current charitable spending while at the same time not inhibiting the growth of such foundations and therefore the ability to provide for future charitable spending. Turning to the issue of incentives, Harvard professor Daniel Halpin has pointed out the benefit of income tax exemption creates an incentive with respect to endowment spending. By excluding endowment investment income from tax, the federal government has, probably unintentionally, created a system that favors saving your money, getting the investment returns tax-free, and then spending that money sometime in the future. It can therefore be argued that the federal government should create a counter-incentive to balance that perhaps unintentional incentive to spend money later. There are two problems with this counter-incentive argument. First, current congressional proposals would simply require fixed annual percentage payout from endowments that is not based on any attempt to merely balance the existing spend later incentive. Second, the change that in theory would exactly balance out this existing incentive, simply removing the income tax exemption for endowment income, has its own problems. One problem is that schools will be able to reduce the amount of income subject to tax by investing both in assets that appreciate but do not generate income and investing in assets that generate tax-exempt income, such as tax-exempt bonds. The other problem is that removing the exemption for endowment income might actually lead to more funds being placed in endowments. If schools are trying to create a certain level of future income stream to support their operations, and the government says the income from endowments can be subject to tax, schools are actually going to increase the amount they put in the endowment so that their after-tax level of income is sufficient for their projected future needs. There's a second reason, though, to justify a federal role. Members of Congress can, and have in fact, pointed to the apparent success of the government-imposed spending requirements on another type of charity. For the past 40 years, private grant-making foundations have had to spend approximately 5% of their assets annually on charitable activities. At the same time, the number and size of such foundations has grown significantly, therefore apparently not sacrificing future charitable spending for the sake of current charitable spending. For example, recently we've seen the formation of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with which its over $20 billion worth of assets has to spend $1 billion a year on current charity. Yet that has not prevented that foundation from growing or from other donors to arise to that foundation. Now, the apparent successes of spending requirements for private grant-making foundations may not be transferable to schools for several reasons. First, Congress enacted these rules for private foundations because they had substantial evidence that many private foundations were refusing to spend more than minimal amounts on current charitable activities. Congress traced this refusal to the fact that these foundations only had to answer to the single donor or small group of related donors who both funded and controlled these foundations. Once these donors received their charitable contribution deductions when they gave the money to the foundation, they had little incentive to spend those charitable funds that were in the foundation beyond their own charitable visions. Schools are different. They have a much larger and varied constituencies that demand current spending, including not only donors, students, faculty, and alums, but also the public, and as recent events have shown, politicians. Schools also have extensive ongoing financial demands that place pressure on them to spend now rather than later, including those arising from long-term employees, extensive facilities, and hard-won reputations. Congress, in fact, has recognized that five foundations that actually engage in direct charitable activities, such as running museums, should be subject to less restrictive rules. The Getty Museum in Los Angeles is one prominent example of such a foundation. For this reason, these so-called private operating foundations only have to spend between 3.5% and 4.25% of their investment assets annually on charitable activities. Perhaps not coincidentally, almost all schools with endowments already spend at least this much on current operations. Finally, the endowments of schools vary greatly, both in relative size to school budgets and with respect to how much such endowments are subject to donor-imposed as opposed to school-imposed restrictions. Private grant-making foundations generally have neither of these concerns. The level of grant-making is directly related to their primary and often sole source of funding, endowment income. And the restrictions on their endowments are usually from one source, the original donor or donors, and apply to all of their endowment. Where this leads us is that perhaps the most critical aspect of determining who should decide is who is best equipped to decide, given the many uncertainties regarding whether spending now is better than spending later and how much spending now. For private grant-making foundations, the answer appears to have been the federal government, because the limited pressures on such foundations to spend currently and the apparent salutary effects of a fixed annual payout requirement, as shown by the past 40 years. The answer, however, is much less clear with respect to schools. College and universities face multiple pressures to spend funds now as opposed to later. Though we're against any tendencies on the part of trustees or other insiders at a school to build up endowments unnecessarily. School trustees and administrators also are more familiar with both the current and likely future financial demands they face than members of Congress are likely to be. Finally, at least the current congressional proposals take a one-size-fits-all approach, which fails to acknowledge the variations in endowment sizes and donor-imposed restrictions. Now, this is not to say that a more refined proposal might not be able to accommodate these concerns while still prompting more current endowment spending by schools that perhaps have either been unnecessarily limited in such spending or have accumulated endowments that are so large that continued maintenance at that level is unjustified. To give an example, Canada has adopted a set of rules that both limits the ability to accumulate endowments and requires a modest amount of endowment spending. Its law first limits the amount that trustees or charities can set aside as endowment by requiring charities to spend annually at least 80% of the gifts they received in the previous year. Donors can avoid this requirement by requiring that their gift be held in perpetuity or for a period that is at least 10 years, or by making the gifts the request. Even for such gifts, however, there's a requirement that generally at least 3.5% of such endowment funds be spent annually on charitable activities. Even for that requirement, there is a way out. The Canadian government can waive this payout requirement if a charity is able to demonstrate, for example, that a combination of shrinking endowment investments and donor restrictions make it impossible for the charity to comply in a given year. No member of Congress, however, has so far put forward any proposal that even approaches the current Canadian law in its sophistication. So what is clear is that it is not easy to answer the two questions with which we started. Whether it is better to spend more now or later depends on financial planning and intergenerational equity issues, for which answers are not easily available and may vary significantly from school to school. Whether it is better for schools or the federal government to decide this first question depends on the relative institutional competence of each entity, which may in turn depend on whether the proposed government solution reflects an understanding of the complexity of this issue. What is also clear, however, is that in an era of rising education costs and demands, but also growing endowments, despite the recent but almost certainly temporary downturn, this issue is unlikely to disappear from the agendas of either schools or Congress.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit our website at federalsociety.org/multimedia.